even if the no doubt was cited, only applied if there was a marital relationship was completed. Things were completed in the body, completed. However, dealing with wonderful yeshiva boys, yeshiva girls, when they get married, very frequently they don't know exactly what happened. They get to call all the time. There was no doubt, and I don't know what exactly happened. First marriage, even if the no doubt was cited, only applied if there was a marital relationship was completed. Things were completed in the body, completed. However, dealing with wonderful yeshiva boys, yeshiva girls, when they get married, very frequently they don't know exactly what happened. They get to call all the time. There was no doubt, and I don't know what exactly happened. That, how am I supposed to know? I say, always say, Baruch Hashem. So we have the last outpost of morality in the whole world. Really, I'm not kidding. The last outpost, the last, is thank God the whole yeshiva of men and women who observe the Shulchan Aruch. There's no one else to experience anymore. Nobody. And I, you know, answer the question. It's like, I answer the question. And the halacha is nothing is seen unless it's a complete relation, then there's no status of neither. If you assume that maybe the hymen is still intact, it wasn't ruptured yet, as the case may be. I should add at this point that the original prohibition, which we discussed about a woman, a man and wife, husband and wife, who have not had relations yet, that they cannot be together through the status of neither, is a problem. What happens? This also happens sometimes. If a couple is married, it's just tahora, everything's fine. But they just can't get together. They're just not able to consummate the marriage completely. And then, boom, they try once, whatever, twice, two times, then nature takes its course, and the period begins. Oh, not going to try the other way. Do we now have to go find chaperones for the next 12 days? Because after all, the marriage was not consummated. Here we are much more lenient. When we say, Lord, there was any kind of beginning of the consummation, this suffices. So that's enough to permit the seclusion of husband and wife. It is not enough to warrant the status of neither if nothing was seen. I'm just giving you very kinship, but these are some laws which, although really we're talking about people already married, but it's good to know them because children will be married, Mr. Shem. People want to know what's happening in our cities, their friends are getting married. This is in a very brief what the halacha said about let's go to the next stage. Yes?
A woman who's getting married for a second time does not have the opinion of Dom Kuhn.
Absolutely not. I would hope not.
I mean, but you can, so just because, Well,
it's a good question based on the issue of that you don't want any abuse in the marriage and the hashkafa.
Well, I know that.
It's better without it.
Hashkafa, but, you know, you know how to treat a husband. That's all right. Period. Anyway. We shouldn't joke about this because, unfortunately, I must tell you that I may make it a side comment. I received a phone call last week from somebody in the community who's not here right now about the terrible problem of abuse. And a woman was literally battered women in the Orthodox community. That's more than Islam. And, you know, there's no words strong enough to condemn any beginning of such behavior. Now, you understand where I hold about this matter. But I just want to say that we really should make these jokes because unfortunately there are women who are really suffering. If you know about someone, call me up. Or call someone else. I don't want to go. Thank you. Thank you. Got a question?
Why do you know that you're not
a student?
Why
Okay, so there are two ways in which a woman can be a non-pasula. Either she lived with someone before the marriage, and this has happened, so let's go, what are we kidding? I had a shala yesterday. Sorry if I digress, but it's too interesting to leak up. I had a shala like this from a rabbi who I know well. He has to speak to me, came from Eretz Yisrael, has to speak to me. There's a woman, a young woman he knows from Eretz Yisrael, who is now the best, the most room and wonderful and ethical and all, everything she thinks is terrific, and she's in the parish of Shidduchim. She can find this road, whatever she is now, when she was 16 years old in high school, in a yeshiva high school, she's no longer a besula. And the question becomes, must she back all this every person that she goes out with at one time, and she can feel it completely? You know, he said that, you know, the better the truth is that if someone is not observant during their adolescent years, for example, was at a college dorm, something of this nature, in today's world of the United States, so sort of assume what goes on in these dormitories, you don't have to say anything. See, you want to know that's true in America, too. Everyone in America can assume, things haven't gone that big. I told him I didn't think that could be concealed, of course. How is it developed? When? That's something which has to be discussed very carefully. That's just a digression. Your question is, you in that kind of a case? Or perhaps something else was a medical procedure which was done. There were all kinds of theories, something that people horseback riding that could do it, something that something was on the horseback riding for that reason. Or whatever other activities could lead to such a result. The general rule is, if we know for a fact that there's no down the sula whatsoever, there's a good reason for it, we know it's been checked out, and the law is not as much. That's what we generally assume. Okay. So I've got this question, and I should make this jump to any conclusions. Then going out to the next stage, Mazel Tov. A baby is born. Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem, a wonderful Mazel Tov. Whoever has the privilege to experience the Mazel Tov should be so, so thankful. Deal with someone who have not been privileged to have this Mazel Tov. So difficult. Sometimes this Mazel Tov should never end her and her husband's Thanksgiving to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for this incredible growth. The Mazel Tov. So what happens? So the law is that, if you read the Torah, in the Torah part of Adria, that there are rules and regulations. There's a minimum that has to be kept, 7 days for a boy and 14 days for a girl. After that, yes. That's a good question. It's a good answer, but not for now. Maybe some of the end we'll go into it. But I feel I'm a little behind my schedule. And then, by Torah law, there's a grace period. 33 days for a boy, 66 days for a girl. But the rabbis cut that out. No more grace period. So therefore, you have to go through the whole procedure, which we'll discuss in the Gantu yet. The car, the ship, and the key, the whole business. Have to happened in the case in which a child was born. I should say at the outset that it's very common that this procedure takes a long time. If you have women who the whole life have been regular, they know, every month, no problem. All of a sudden, they call me up. My baby's a month old already, and I still can't have a clean pedicure. It's only 1 month. In the case of 2 months, 3 months. And I should add, that often, yeah, the 6 months too. I should add, that's rare. I should add that there's a big problem with women nursing. Very often the nursing has all kinds of hormonal implications. That means some women nursing see nothing. That's how it was in the time of the Gemara. Others who are nursing have regular periods, blue. But others who are nursing have stains. That's a serious problem. Has to be a case by case basis. Was there Agosha? Was there no Agosha? I don't think you know what. But then the whole thing that we discussed last week. So very, very intricate. I should add one more detail. If a woman miscarries, so she also has to maintain the number of days, which is usually, you know, not a problem because it takes a couple of weeks for things to clear out. But in theory, a woman can be clean within a week. And then she can really go to the mikvah, we'll see soon, within 2 weeks, and then she can't go. Because in the case it was a female that was miscarried, you have that 2 week minimum. If it was miscarriage after 40 days, it's an exception, which is just should be aware, rare case that it happens, it's a 2 week minimum, which is by nature, it can't, wouldn't be relevant anyway. So I just want to reiterate that. Finally,
even if you miscarried,
I said it, 40 days, please. Also, this is an idea which is called the opening of the womb from the outside. Certain medical procedures could accomplish this. and this is the cause of many costs of also great fatalities, even the absence of any doubt. It's called psicha sakeret, it's opened up. So a woman who goes to a medical procedure and the cervical area is open for whatever reason, you have to be careful, ask what happened, ask a shayla, because sometimes this could cause a lot of problems, even in the absence of doubt. Okay. Now that we've gone to what we call the special cases, I want to discuss the very normal, prosaic, average, everyday, every month case. And I want to first discuss the halakhic conduct of the couple during the status of Nida, and then at the end we'll discuss how the status of Nida is in fact changed. So the conduct is found in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Kuf Tzadihei, and the topic is called Harachoko, as the name implies, Harachoko, in the shortest of Rako, distance. This means that there has to be a certain distance between husband and wife during the period of Nida. It's off the beginning. When you were growing up in school, if you went to a Jewish school, they were born, they went spurt, the joke, equipped with something called Negiya. Oh, Negiya, Negiya, Negiya. It's not a halakhic term, really. Negiya and halakhic is something different, but what it means is, in our slang, that not only is relationship is between men and women, and rules, but even physical contact is prohibited. However, according to those authorities, strictly speaking, the only kind of physical contact which is prohibited between a man and a woman is affectionate contact, as opposed to riding on the subway in rush hour, which folks would say is, you know, you have to go out and work, is okay, as opposed to, I don't know, maybe one comes to a kiddush in certain shuls, but it gets a little bit crowded, which is also, strictly speaking, okay, although it's again not ideal.
What about
things
that are
splintered? Yeah, for medical reasons, it's also okay. However, when it comes to a husband and wife, which is in the status of neither, the rabbis prohibited even non-affectionate contact between the parties, and the ground is very simple. What's not affectionate? Husband and a wife told me they obviously have familiarity with one another, and therefore the rabbis were afraid, especially since seclusion is permissible, right? We know that there's no prohibition of yichud, and they are familiar, so therefore they made it went out an extra mile, and they prohibited even non-affectionate contact between husband and wife when she's the status of neither. It's a very important rule to know. Not only that, but the rabbis even prohibited certain verbal, how should I say, communication between husband and wife, according to Shulchan Aruch, and the expression that was used is divrei hergel, schol v'kalas rosh, which means the kind of levity, which is ordinarily very healthy between husband and wife, but it's a kind of a talk which could lead to something, which will lead to something, which will lead to marital relations. It wasn't that great, but now it's just in the status of neither. And then this kind of communication is inappropriate, shouldn't be done. Where you draw the line, how what you may say and may not say, very hard to be specific. I mean, to speak to me about it, they do. I ask, well, what does this mean to you? What does that mean to you? What does every word, these words, you know, some words mean something in somebody's vocabulary, mean nothing in someone else's vocabulary. You know, you say the exact word, because some use it frequently and some use it seldom. So it's hard for me to be too specific, but I think most of you have a sense of what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. Some kind of certain part of the your vocabulary, how you speak to one another, is out of bounds during this period of time when the status neither exists. Okay, now the rabbis go one step further. Shulchan Aruch says, let me give an introduction. Many of these halachos, of these the rules of distance, are controversial, and everyone agrees to them. And there are numerous controversies within the rules and regulations contained in this particular chapter. And one need exercise a measure of caution in instruction to the general community what should be said and what should not be said. Some things just better, or maybe the people will learn it at a later date. Why? In certain circles, one might be afraid that the person is too harsh. Says, well, this is prohibited, that's prohibited, this, I can't take it. Can't take it, so that I can't take this, but I can't observe this particular law, so then we'll chuck the whole thing. That certainly is the last thing from my mind. I received one phone call last week about something that I said, which was, it might be a more lenient view, so maybe we should have a lenient view, because after all, we, for the same reason, and it was a point well taken. You have to know where to draw the line of these matters. So I'm saying, I'm speaking into an audience that I think wants to hear whatever is in the Shulchan Aruch. If something they seem a little bit too overwhelming, maybe you can do that privately, maybe there's some other way how to handle it, but this is what it says more or less in the Shulchan Aruch, although, as you may have already discerned last week, I'm not in the habit of giving strict opinions. When most controversies exist over here, we don't run away to all the stringencies. But nevertheless, there are a lot of sensitive matters over here. And I'm coming to the first one right away. Shulchan Aruch rules that in order to avoid even the non-affectionate contact with your husband and wife during this dance of Nida, not only may they not actually touch each other, but they may not even pass things to one another. You pass it to somebody, pass the salt. I pass you the salt, I'm passing the salt to you. So I have, how big is the salt check? I'm only starting to so much ago, and they said, you know, so we touch. So ordinarily, it's not a problem. Well, the person's passing it to a man to another man, or to another woman, even a man to a woman, over to a man. You go to a store to get change. So if you go to borrow a pocket, put it down on the table. But if you go to Riverdale, a school of the modern community, they'll hand it to you. Woman to man to woman. Huh? As long as nothing bad intended, it's okay. That's what's called non-affectionate contact. Maybe we discuss handshaking, perhaps if there's that pattern, or she's not sure about it. The husband and wife know. And therefore they even prohibited passing things because it may lead, very likely it might lead to this kind of contact. Some folks can say that the Shasat Kach, there's no alternative, one can be lead in this matter. It's a controversial ruling. Not everyone agrees to this ruling in the Shulchan Aruch. I have one major case where I think it's permissible, although it's not agree with me, that is babies. This comes a little from experience. I've seen babies put down on the floor, you know, so the baby is very strict, you know. They put the little infant down on the floor, and then one picks it up. All right, that's the shot they received, the more power to them. All right, wonderful. It shows the serious nefesh. But
when you do something like
that,
especially in public,
that's
also a sense of
sneeze,
right?
That's true. Someone asked Rabbi Shah, about sneeze? So Rabbi Shah wrote back in Shiva, which I don't understand. And we'll discuss probably a little more next week. Rabbi Shah writes in Shiva, I mean, on the contrary, if a woman has this natural phenomenon, which is healthy, Baruch Hashem, a woman would not have never have a sin of neither, then it would mean she'd be unhealthy. I have another case hanging out with a very serious situation of the hormonal imbalance, not healthy. So that is hopefully I agree. And therefore she won't be embarrassed. So that part, I don't know enough to say about that particular subject, but from everything that I've seen, the last statement doesn't seem to be accurate. Today's rule. Maybe it was accurate 50 years ago. Yes?
I
mean, I'm holding a platter and the other party picks the bread off the platter. That's a question. Putting things in a pocketbook or out of a pocket. These are all questions. So, yeah, there's a question. Then there's more room to be lenient when it's necessary. Yes?
What about similar to what Leah was saying, but in the presence of company? Well, you're sitting around a table.
So you have to try to be as much as sweet as possible, and chacham eino b'rosho, someone who plans a little bit doesn't want everyone to know. So you figure out ways and means. how to try to avoid such uncomfortable situations, if at all possible. Yes?
No, well, a lot of us who have a tendency to regularly do it that way, like every Shabbos, if your husband doesn't, you finish cup or whatever, so then it won't be obvious when you're not doing it.
We'll come to
Kiddush.
Right, okay, we'll come to a very good point. We'll come to Kiddush soon. Okay, so one of the reasons why I feel that it's permissible to put, give the baby over, see, some say, there's an expression in the Gemara, Chai nos deis atzmo, that the baby can carry itself. So you're not giving the baby over, the baby is going over. Well, at a certain age, I thought that maybe that's really a reason, which is given, the real reason is, because the baby is in need. For example, the Shulchan Aruch later on, if it's a cold, someone is sick, then it's permissible to hand things, etc. Well, the baby is not chalila sick, but it's the equivalent of sick. On Shabbos, whatever permissibility is given for a sick person applies to all babies. They're healthy because they're in need. That's the main reason that I have said this. But again, there are those who disagree with me. Okay. What about when a couple eats together? Husband and wife.
Along.
Oh.
Along.
I heard you.
Children.
So the Shulchan Aruch says that there has to be a heker, a distinguishing factor that should be clear to them that this status exists. There's a number of reasons given for this. One is they shouldn't come to touch one another. One, they shouldn't eat from each other's remnants, which we'll come to a little bit later. In my opinion, one can be lenient and dispense with this distinguishing sign if others are around the table. Because many say if others are around the table, then there can't be too much affection and closeness in that sense between husband and wife. Everyone's looking, everyone's around. That's the official reason. My reason is what you said before. That wouldn't bother me so much, but the fact that if others are around, there might be more of an embarrassment factor. Therefore, since to avoid embarrassment, if there is a lenient view, you have a right to rely on that lenient view. So if there's no one else is around, no one is around, so then there shouldn't be any embarrassment. If someone else is around, it's not required. What's called around? Maybe it's a couple just getting married, and even someone's got company and not a couple. If it's a couple with children, so what's around? Children are around the table there. If you don't have children, they go for the kid leaves. So, kid left, they have to wait, put up. I don't think it's that second, because those can always come back. They don't want it back to come back.
The one hand constitutes
when the child is there, you don't feel alone. You know, you would be feeling somewhat inhibited by the presence of that child. 2 years old, I don't know, 1 year old, I don't even know what depends on how close the child is. Okay. Fine. There are rules and regulations about the remnants of food and drink. The woman drinks a cup of wine, drinks half, and leaves over the other half. The man's not supposed to drink from that cup. That's romance. You drink the wine, I drink the rest of the wine. So that's considered off limits during this time. Similarly, the woman shouldn't pour the wine or other drink for her husband, certainly in his presence, because that's also considered some kind of an act of affection. Moreover, the husband shouldn't send, if you will, a cup of wine to his wife. That's the Kiddush problem, as we mentioned before. What do you do about Kiddush? Well, you do a couple of things. If nobody, they got the same story all over again, if the couple by themselves, it's got no problem. The husband drinks from the Kiddush cup. He can put the Kiddush cup down. And the wife may drink the remnants, one of the many pulses. She may drink his remnants. Moreover, however, I should say, he shouldn't give it to her. He puts it down and she drinks from it. This can be done even without a dog present. Nothing wrong with that. But often it's a little bit clumsy. So what could be done, in my opinion, I think most agree with me, is that if there are others around, the husband, before he drinks, pours up a bunch of cups. He doesn't designate whose is whose. Some couple that says the world's best team or something like that. That would be a problem. But if it's just, 5 cups, or 10 cups, And then we have potluck, who gets what? See, all these pouring a cup for her. Which one? That's what we do. It's in our house, it's always on that way. No matter what, it's just like you said before, you don't make any distinctions. That's what I do every week. I pour the cups out, and everyone just takes cups.
And the woman take it for her. Pass
down for a dish. Yeah, that's how we usually work. I pour the cups, and the dishes sort of passed around, and everyone takes a cup, and that's the mission. Yeah.
I think this is
funny.
Husband
drinks from the cup, and then goes to a child, and then it's like that. Yeah, if the husband drinks from the cup, and if someone drinks from that, then she drinks from the trivial.
Was that pouring out from the cup to your own glass? Is that already okay.
But that's okay from the perspective of these halachos, but not so great from the perspective of kiddush. It's become a little bit complicated. It's a combination of two halachos, the laws of kiddush. Let's just leave that out for a moment. Again, with a little bit too much detail, and I want to go a little further. The husband's not supposed to sit on the bed of the wife, even if she's not there. Also, the bed should not touch. You know that you have to have two separate beds. In America today, what's this? What kind of marriage is this? You have to have these, you know, these. Yeah. So that's the no-no. The knowledge should be two separate beds, but that shouldn't touch. So the whole have their own answer. Some people say, well, so now it will touch, now it won't touch. I'll move it this way, I'll move it that way, I'll always be this way. I can't advise. In my opinion, it's better to stay the same way the whole time. Otherwise, if this and that, people come into the room, they're not supposed to come in. Kids don't come into the room. But you know, they're always there, like I said. They're always there. So, better things are just left the same way. How much for them should be from others? So, Cedar should post them, they have to be way far. There have to be something in between. I think they have to be as far as the two bedspreads shouldn't touch each other. That's all. If the bedspread goes down, they don't touch each other. That's far enough. What does that take? It depends how big the bedspreads are. What apart, 6 inches apart. That's expensive. You have to use judgment in this area. Also, the wife should not make the husband's bed if he's in the room, he's in his presence, when he's looking. That's also considered an act of affection. Okay. Now, finally, when the woman is in status of nida, the husband is prohibited from certain kinds of how should I put it? Activities which might lead to something which is bad. And one of them is called staring, gazing at a part of his wife, which ordinarily is covered. In other words, the man's wife is beautiful, she's so beautiful, and she's a status of nida. He looks at her straight in the eye, says, "You're beautiful." I'm saying, it depends on what you said every day, or it's a little once in my year. So, but the gaze upon her beauty is permissible. That's only the parts which are ordinarily exposed. But parts which are not, then it's considered inappropriate. During this period of time, and there's a whole discussion, what's called this, what's called that, because you know, as most possible say, or Moshe says, depends how she usually goes in the house, not how she usually goes in the street. But, you know, in the house, you can go, no one there, they can go dressed differently, etc., etc. So, therefore, in my opinion, a woman who is permitted to keep her hair uncovered in the privacy of her home, it flies all the time when she's in the status of nida, because in my opinion, again, there's no prohibition against that the man looking at his wife, which is nida, even though the hair is not covered. It also leaves, you know, people walk around different ways in the house. Again, this prohibition wouldn't apply. Others, you know, ordinarily covered, then this prohibition would exist. What about a singing voice, Kol Isha? Again, it's a controversy, and I think there's grounds to be lenient in this regard. Some disagree, but I think it's a ground to use there. That was a very brief overview of this complicated topic, and if there are any questions about it, you can ask me certainly later or call me up, and I'll be happy to try to speak to you about it. I know this could be a cause of serious emotional stress, You know, once it's a cold, I still remember it was the night before Rosh Hashanah. You know, it seems the date sticks in your head. As I answered, the night before Rosh Hashanah was a busy time. I got a call from a couple, Colin and I. We have problems. And the problem is this, not the laws of Taras and Shpachah, so that they're 100%, but these, all these things are past now, this, you know, and the woman says, I know, my husband, he's, doesn't bother him, but it bothers me. Because, you know, there's an emotional distance. And it's true, but you see, it's a delicate balance. The rabbis insist that a woman, when she's in the status of Nida, should wear makeup and whatever other tashitim, jewelry, so she should not chalila lo tizgan al baal. She shouldn't look somehow, she's not pleasing to her husband in terms of the way her appearance is. At the same time, they're afraid not to be, go too far. It's a tightrope. You know, very often, young men who are so careful to do things properly, they maybe go in the room too much in the strict direction. You have to loosen up a little bit, you know. It's a tough line to draw, and I try to help them. Even though Deborah Rosh Hashanah is a little upset, why they couldn't pick a better time to call me up. But I guess that was New Year's resolution. Why not the year right? Try to help them. This is, okay, we now come to the final part of the shiur. How has the status of Nida come to an end? The first step is called a Hefsek Tara. Hefsek Tara means an examination, an internal examination, which can only take place, practically speaking, after 5 days from the onset of the period. Usually, it really doesn't matter too much because most women, the period lasts that amount of time anyway, so they get a clean examination. But even if they can get earlier, they have to wait for this requisite period of time. There's a complicated reason why. It has to do with the Shlosh Smei Hagbola, which we read about in Parshas Yisro, and there's Oletes. We're not going to go into the details now. That's the general rule. There's certain exceptions, and not too many. When should this Hefsek Tara be done? So, strictly speaking, in almost all conditions, circumstances can be done any time during the day. And it could just be an internal examination, which a woman has a cloth, a legal cloth, that she inserts it internally with her finger, and we'll describe it a little later how she does it. And it's clean, but the Hefsek Tara. However, there are two laws which the rabbis would recommend, Halacha recommends, preferably for Hefsek Tara. One, that should be done in the late afternoon, if possible. And two, that during what we call the Ben Hashmashos time frame, which is the astronomical sunset, until, let's say, half an hour after, approximately, to be something which is called a Mo Dachuk, which means a floor or a tampon which is inserted to make sure that there should be nothing was missed, and that in fact it should be clean as well. If it's impossible, then you can do without the Mo Dachuk, you can do without the late afternoon Bidik, you can do it earlier as well.
On which day?
We're talking about the fifth day.
So you can do it before the fifth day is complete?
The same period began on Sunday. So on Thursday afternoon, or even Thursday morning, for that matter, if you can, it's better Thursday afternoon. If you can't do it Thursday afternoon, you can do it Thursday morning. The woman comes to work, and she can't do it at work. And it's when she gets back from work, it's already dark. It must be done before sunset. So she can do it Thursday morning. Probably may not be clean at Thursday morning. All right, so then to try to find someone to do the work, yes? No, I could always try to do it in the morning. But
That's okay.
Yeah, but you should, right. No contradiction. Do it in the morning, if it's clean, why not? They can forget. They can forget in the afternoon. Do it in the morning, at least you have that to rely upon.
Okay.
Good.
So
that's what I said.
Even though it's paper,
is that important? Doesn't matter. But as long as it's a medika preceded, a regular medika cloth before the sunset, and for that, whatever's more comfortable, either a cloth or a tent. Now, this medika has to be thorough, which means that the cloth which is used has to be go around and around, and woman holds it with a finger, it goes around and around, so to make sure that all the walls, the surface of all the walls in that area are clean. It's very important. How deep must it be? That's already a question. Some suggest it should be as deep as possible, but not too deep. Don't hurt yourself. Don't scratch yourself. There are women who unfortunately inflict wounds upon themselves by being too aggressive in this fatigue process. That's not what the halacha wants. So be very careful to be delicate in doing this procedure. We require, as I said before, cloth. It should be soft cloth. We have these special fatigue cloths that you can get in the mikvah. Some use old t-shirts or other kinds of cloth. I think that's the right kind. It should be soft. It should be abrasive. That's very important. You can't use your finger. Unfortunately, for those who put it, that's not acceptable. You shouldn't use paper, as I mentioned before. And you shouldn't use a tampon either for the, because they can't get into the crevices. So this is why, what the halacha states about the bidik.
Does it have to be a cloth family
that's in the college room? I believe so. But the best thing is cotton rather than the college room. Yeah. Oh, I was about to say. Usually, they traditionally would use a dry cloth. However, if this would cause an abrasion or an irritation, the pasuk say you may wet the cloth. Some say if that will have to be put to a kind of lubricant on the cloth. You don't recommend that because it alters the color. But if there's no alternative, perhaps you can use these in that case too. But simply wetting it usually does the trick.
Okay? So,
yes, you can wet it. You have to. Okay? This is what's called a hefsektara. The hefsektara now sets into effect the final stage, which is the Shiva Nakiyah, the seven clean days which are required. During these seven clean days, Shulchan Aruch requires two examinations daily, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. Other folks would say, you know, that's the old days when women had ample time with the day. You do one examination a day, it's also good. I always say do it in the morning, because it's way in the afternoon. If you don't have a chance, you know, when you're at work or busy or this or that, only have your morning bedika, that's okay. I should add that many posts will say that the bedika must take place by day as opposed to by night. It has to be done by day. I disagree with most say, many say, most, has to be done by day. What does day mean? From sunrise to sunset. That could be a problem, because you see, today the sun rose at 7:20. So it kind of looks a bit of a problem. So some say that, well, if it's done dawn, it's good enough. Dawn is an hour plus before that. But ideally, it should be done between sunrise and sunset. And usually, sunrise is early enough that in America, we don't get up that early. Usually. But times like this of the year, it could pose a potential problem. Okay. What happens if a woman did not check herself every day of the 7 days of the Shiva and the Kiyum? So, it's one of the favorite rules taught in some of the college classes, that you get with it. Well, you know, as long as you did a bedik on day one and on day seven, good enough. True. Not denying. True. It's called vidyeva, after the fact. Could, for some reason, it couldn't be done. For some reason not to do it, that is the fight. But I'm very hesitant to recommend that it should be done. Unfortunately, there are those who recommend it as a matter of course. They probably mean well, because, you know, problems, etc. But it could cause disaster. For example, the following quote, which I've had many times. Rabbi, I forgot to do my bedikah on the seventh day. It's the cause of the Shulchan Aruch. Forget the bedikah on the seventh day, you start all over again. You can lose a whole week if you did it only the first day. So that's to prevent that from happening. I tell those women who for some reason have to cut down the bedikas, for whatever reason, it's legitimate, they should at least do one more time. We'll say 1, 4, and 7. It was a midpoint. So in case they forget 7, they can still recoup and do it, and 1, 4, and 8, according to the most authorities, is sufficient. But to rely on the 1 and 7 is what's called brinksmanship. You mean, one mistake and you're out. So I don't recommend that at all. I recommend every day. I'm giving you a break. Shavuot is twice a day. Stop saying, all right, once. If a person does a bedika, let's say day 1, 4, and 8, so according to most authorities, it's good enough. But as long as they were not six days it intervenes, you're medikas, and it's okay, you maintain the continuity.
And the seventh day, even if you do the bedikah in the morning, it's enough? You can go to the mikvah at night, you don't have to do it?
That's right. This idea of a bedikah, when you're in the mikvah, before the mikvah, is a myth. There's no such law.
Let's say you went to the mikvah a week late.
As long as you do the bedikah on day one through seven, worst case, even one at seven, you're...
If you go to the mikvah late, you don't have to, for whatever reason, you don't have to do any more bedikah.
That's correct. Pay the cop. I'm down to those two women, because obviously there are those two women. I'm playing my opinion for that. Yeah.
If for some reason you were in a community that there is no Arab, or you do not hold an Arab, and you have a Muslim in you, is that considered?
Stay home. That's right. Muhtakuk is a problem of believe it or not, a whole solar problem. There's no Arab in the community. Because if a woman has a period, she needs it for physical protection, and she has something to protect, what we call protection, that's okay. That's a physical need. But if also look at that time of the, that stage, there's really nothing there, is a halakhic need. So either stay home or do without the halakhic. You don't have to have it. All right, anyway. Yes. These 7 days must be clean without interruption. You can't say, well, I have one clean day, and the next day was not clean, and okay, but it's kind of left, one left. No. It's a stain, no. This is a bedikah, which proves to be not proper. But during the seventh, you then got to start all over again. What is the shiloh? A shiloh is a question. So the shiloh should be shown to her own. You should pass it, who has some experience. Possible what the bit is. It's red this way, it's pink that way, it's brown the other way. It's an orange shadow, a rare. Yes?
Let's say somebody sees a stain during Shiva Nikiyam and not on a bedikah cloth. Mm-hmm. You should then not do any, do you have the authority on yourself not to do a bedikah, even though you know?
I told last week that if someone sees a stain, there's no need to do a bedikah. In my opinion, that's true. Not only when the woman is
during
the Zion Nikim. Not only true when the woman is from Aura, but it's true even during the Zion Nikim, even during the 7 days. A woman is in the middle of the seventh clean day. Some she loves on a garment, a tiny little bit of stain. This necessitates a full internal examination on the spot. The answer, in my opinion, is no. That's not required. Yeah. I mean, if it can be a lot in this regard, if it's small enough, whatever the rules and regulations of last week, then again, in my opinion, everyone agrees, you can just disregard.
I'm sorry. I was also asking that even if, let's say, you have to ask a question and you can't, for some reason, do not get an answer for the question and a day passes.
Very good. That's what I'm about to come to. If a woman didn't count, you saw those days were voodin, they were lost completely, then either according to the conceptually something because they weren't counted at the time, or practically something because you weren't paying attention to what was happening. So that's important. Never give up. Really. Always, you never know. Maybe it'll be good. This way, if you have a question in your mind, then it's no problem. So once it's a question, so it's all right. Yes? over again, you do have sankara, then maybe worth it for you to do another half sankara before the sunset.
I think it's going to
play
both ways.
You play both ways.
And,
you don't know.
I don't want to give up hope. Right, I
don't want
to give up hope, but you also don't
want
to lose that day.
So you can use your own good judgment. It depends on how you, what you think. I should add as follows. These 17 days are also called, you may leave with, and it's called the Vana, which means white. Traditionally, the woman in these 7 days is supposed to wear white garments, white undergarments, I should say. White sheets was something which was always considered appropriate during this 7 day period. Many people say nowadays that there are what's called tight undergarments, there's no need for white sheets. But in the old days, they didn't have this idea, so they were afraid that it would come out. So I recommend. I recommend the sheets should all be colored. So they don't look to the sheets of this color, they're that color, always colored. The garments change. Right, that the garments we mentioned last week should be colored. During these 7 days, it should be white. There are exceptional cases. One of the problems, one of the reasons, getting through the 17 days, there are some cases that will allow her to wear colored garments even during these 17 days. Some exceptional cases. You can't take the color on your own. And there are some cases that will tell her not to do some of the bedikas. You only do only 1 and 7 or 1, 4 and 7. It depends on the circumstances. Because the halacha recognizes that there's some leniency that could be exercised under certain circumstances. Okay. I thought I'd measure earlier than I did, but it didn't work. Exact same time. Next week, aside from any regular mistakes which I may have made this week, because we started earlier, I would like to speak about mikvah. Means the proper time, the proper preparation, the proper, all these are the laws concerning the mikvah itself. And I want to remind you that we should discuss during the week whether we're going to have a mensch here or not 2 weeks in advance.
Why not?
Because I won't show up. I want to thank the organizers.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for the hospitality. Thank everybody for coming. But of course, without an audience, I think it's possibly a shiur. There was a talk last week about a shiur for men. I haven't heard much a response. If anybody spoken to any of you?
Yeah.
8:15, next Wednesday night, the shiur for men. Now, what we should do, we're really do some of this, you know, throughout the beautiful people. Polkadot is charged. But maybe we can get into this.
Who would you really go to the center?
No, they're open to downstairs. And this is the grand finale, and this really, the truth to tell, is the most appropriate shiur of all, in the fact of the sponsor being the mikvah committee, because tonight we're discussing the law of the mikvah, the law of the tzvila. And if you remember last week, I brought in a medical body that shows a beautiful blue cover. Well, he has a second volume, which is titled Law of the Tzvila. It's more manageable. We'll be discussing some of the highlights of the Lord of the Tzvila this evening. Unfortunately, there's no, I guess I could make corrections for the men's class. I always like to have the option to make a correction. I really should comment, this was one form which was brought out, both in a phone call a week ago, as well as in our last session. I really should say that this is a shiur which is limited to the laws of Nida, Taras, Mishpacha, Tzvila. It is not really concerning itself with the laws of tzniyus, the laws of modesty in this area, although there are references here and there. And so therefore, I don't want to make a definitive statement about the laws of tzniyus. Whatever was said here in this year was said based on what's been in the Shulchan Aruch, and of course, the individuals who are different
decisions or different rulings. It's not for this series to go into these details as far as I'm concerned. Let's go back now to what we're discussing, the laws of the region. Shulchan Aruch tells us in Sefer Kuf Tzadi Zayin that a woman should go to the mikveh as soon as possible, and this probably finds up as we discussed last week. And at the first available opportunity, one should go to the mikveh. The discussion began, it's really not found in Shulchan Aruch, but happened in a situation in which the husband is not around. So in Shulchan Aruch, when it phrases itself, it says that in Baal of a year, if the husband is there, then it's a mitzvah to do the meal at the earliest possible time. What if the husband is not there? So there are very divergent customs in this area. Some say, no way, husband is not in town, you're not permitted to go to the mitzvah. It's a terrible thing. Some of you are somehow tweetsus and they're inappropriate. And others, and I belong to the second camp, since I come from the left Hasidic schooling, I said, no, go as early as possible. You never know when they'll show up. And I can tell you a story, you know, I wasn't supposed to come, and then the convention was cut short, and this and that, and no more. Call, wake up the big lady at 3 a.m. or whatever. So, you know, I feel it's a mitzvah. The reason my people in the mitzvah, they do it right away. You know, maybe different reasons, different circumstances. They didn't want to do it for a whole variety of reasons. But I think it should be done as quickly as possible. As quickly as possible, don't mean at night. The halacha is that a woman must go to the mikveh at night. The seventh day, which is the last day of the seventh day, the seventh day of Shiva Nikim, by Torah law, one may immerse herself during the day. The famous principle which is known as mitzvah sayof kulo. It means that the part of the day is enough. Some of you may know it's called the unfortunately of Shiva. The Shiva is over in the morning. Because as soon as the down the chakra, it's over, the part of the day is the whole day. Well, in a sense, in a happier note, the Torah has the same ruling over here. Part of the day which is clean and the key is Shiva Nikim is enough. That's by Torah law. But the problem. The problem is what would happen if a woman would have a riyaz dam, which would be somehow would be some bleeding later on in that day. So the rule would be that it turns out that retroactively she never was tahora. The entire immersion of the mikveh was the north. You see, you go early in the day, as long as it's going to be clean for the rest of the day. But things go wrong at the end. That's because in retrospect, there was nothing, because you didn't have to have a clean day at the end. It could be what we call a stira, contradiction. In this context, it means a cancellation, in a better way. A cancellation of the seventh day by that didus at the very end of the seventh day. Meanwhile, you could have been with a husband, and it could have been a terrible, terrible violation of the most serious nation. So for this reason, the rabbis tell us, not only must she refrain from being with her husband during that seventh day, but the rabbis were afraid she'd go to the mikveh, she'll be impatient. So therefore, they prohibited going to the mikveh completely until nightfall. After it gets dark, thoughts come out, whatever that means, when it gets dark, then she's permitted to go to the mikveh, but then she can be with her husband, and even if she is with her husband and then an hour later she's done, so what? It only started an hour later, but it's not something going retroactively. But rather, the dam would be seen on the seventh day, which is still day, then it would be retroactively rendering the entire seventh-day unit as null and void. Okay, it's very important to understand.
I don't understand the difference between that and if it would happen an hour after night, you know, after.
A woman.
Well, either way, she would have to start counting.
Oh, of course, it starts here on in.
Right.
The question is, what happened in the past? Every woman. Go to the mikveh a month, and 2 weeks later she may see again. It's a big deal. That's the way the Torah ordained it. We don't say that whatever happened those 2 weeks was impermissible in retrospect. It was permissible, it was a mitzvah. But if it happened on the seventh day proper, then in retrospect there were no 7 days. So although she was able to cut it off, cut it short in the middle, but that's only going to be clean the rest of the day. We don't know what happened proper. We don't know that. So therefore, the rabbi said, don't take any chances, wait till nightfall in order to go to the mikvah. Is that clear? I want to make sure you get the underpinning. It's important to know what's what, because otherwise people can get confused and they don't understand what it's all about. They think it's just dry. There's a reason for everything. Everything has a reason. Here the reason is quite clear. You may say, no problem. I'll go to the mikvah the eighth day. Sure good. You go to the mikvah the eighth day, she goes to the mikvah the eighth day. She's with her husband the eighth day. She sees Dom the afternoon of the eighth day. So what? It's the eighth. She could have gone the night before, so it's not the... not based on what we call mitzvah sayom b'kul. It's not based on the father's day, it's the whole day. It's completely over. You're right. There's a problem. The rabbis are very smart. And they knew that women are very, very bright and intuitive. And they know that a woman's daughter somehow can figure out at times where mommy's going. The daughter figured out that mommy's going to the mikvah by day, the eighth day, but she's not supposed to get it. She knows it by day. She doesn't feel it's the eighth day. When she grows up, she says, well, I saw my mommy went on by day, so I'll also go by day. But she, you won't go the eighth day, she'll go in the seventh day. And then she's going to have the whole problem with this. That's the reason why you may not even go on the eighth day. You should srap pito, the Gemara tells us, and quote the Shulchan. So the rabbis had it all figured out, you know, that this may happen, that may happen, the third may happen, and then they believe it. However, on the eighth day, there's a leniency according to some authorities, I don't confess to some do. If she leaves her house by day and immerses by day, returns home by night. If she returns home by night, she can't be with her husband, and the daughter won't really know. So then, even though the immersion was by day, as long as she returns by night on the eighth day, some authorities say it's permissible. This is relevant, by the way. Not on the Shabbos, it's relevant for those. Some people couldn't go through the night. But it's relevant also for different cases. Some people live miles and miles from the mikvah, hours trips. You know, we're used to having one down the block. But you go out to the west somewhere, and people that will go on the car ride for hours and hours, and they're afraid to drive by night. For good reason. So they often, in this case, the ruling is, if a woman is afraid to go at night, and it's good, that's paranoid, but there's a good reason to be afraid to go at night, you're allowed to go by day, but if we try to arrange to come back after nightfall. So what would happen somewhere in the west, they go on the 8th day, a 3-hour trip, and they arrange to come back just as it gets dark. It's already the 8th night. That's what some do. I'll just give you an example of something which is sometimes done. There are a number of other reasons why it's impossible to go to the mikvah by night. Now is another reason now in today's modern world. Who would work so late? I had the case. A woman was an all-night nurse. She had a night shift. And it was the summertime. And she was on at 8 and off at 4. Something like that. And then the whole night was the night started at 9 and ended at 3 or 4. So it was done. She couldn't go. So I don't know. So an interesting story happened. In some communities, there was an abuse of the exceptional case of when a woman was permitted to go to the mikvah by day. There are exceptional cases. As you said, on the eighth day, if a woman is afraid, that's one example. She's afraid of lying. That was the case of the Gemara. We'll lie about the streets at night. Whatever. I don't want to say anything. After election day, let's not get involved with this anymore. But still, there could be cases which is afraid of people on the street at night. It really is ground for it. Then, in some circumstances, it's permissible to go by day. However, even though it's permissible in these cases where afraid of thieves or lions or they close the gates, it's only in those special and unique cases. It's not only, and it's only on the eighth day. It's only in a very unique and special situation. In some communities with abuse, Willow would tell up stories, you know, I'm this and I'm that and the other thing, and it wasn't true. So they made it what they call a low flume. The rabbis made a no exception rule. You cannot go to the mikvah by day, period. You can stand on your head. Well, there's one exception, a kala. A kala may go by day because she's not getting married yet, not with a husband yet. And that they still accept because you have to prove that you're a kala. But no exception. So a rabbi from that community called me up, you know, I have this lady, she's a nurse, born all night, and she works in the city, it's some suburban community, and she won't let her use the mikvah here by day, no matter what. Could you please use your mikvah by day? I might say so, this is an exception. But yes, she was arranged with the acceptance, and she was able to go in the daytime. But this is a woman who simply could not go by night whatsoever. Many women don't, and it's a matter of convenience. You have much more convenience by day. Or it's a matter of embarrassment. They don't want to know about it. They don't want to go by day. As much as I am a big advocate of tzivus, so we can front and behind when the mikvah is used, nevertheless, the rabbi has not viewed it as a sufficient cause to allow the woman to go to the mikvah by day. So therefore, very, very great exception. We don't allow women, even in our community, to use the mikvah day, not the eighth day, certainly not the seventh day. A number of stories happened here in our mikvah, but before I get the stories, I'll just finish these dinim, and then we'll get the stories. For those more interested, let's first go to the dinim, and then we'll get the stories. What happens if a woman can't go to the mikvah three straight nights. Let me explain what happened until now. If a woman, let's break the bottom of it. This will call 7, 8, and 9. The woman talks about the mikvah, the night, we'll call it the seventh night, the night after the seventh day of the Shiva season. She spoke to them. If she can't go then, and she can go the next night, she's required to go the next night. You know this concession to go by day, what's the point? No point going by day, you go the next night. So therefore, she can go the next night. The only time allowed to go by day, there's a possible to go the seventh at night, possible to go the eighth at night. Then, in these rare conditions, we allow the woman to go to the eighth by day. Okay? What happens if she can't go by the seventh at night, she can't go the eighth at night, and she can't go the ninth at night? An unusual circumstance. Impossible all 3 days. And she, maybe add something. And she can't go the eighth by day either. She can't go the seventh night, or the eighth day, or the eighth night, or the ninth night. Some authorities maintain that there's such extreme situation, because she's late so long, and she may even go the seventh by day. We said before, the real no-no, providing that she returns home either after dark, or if that's impossible, she has to return home right before dark. Her husband has to be out of the house by the time she gets there. Wild, huh? It happened in this community once, in all the years of the mikvah. And to this day, I'm very, very happy that that ruling was issued. The story went as follows. The individual lived very far from the mikvah, very far. It was a legitimate hardship case. So what? So what? This particular individual had a medical situation where the doctor said he really shouldn't walk. She said, don't walk. But she called, it was Hoshana Rabba. Hoshana Rabba on a Wednesday, like it was this year. And said, I'm supposed to go to the mikvah tonight. Although I live, you know, 2 miles away, so big deal, no problem. So, and then I walk home. But the doctor told me not to walk. On the other hand, I have to go to the mikvah. So I'm going to ignore the doctor. I'm going to walk on it, I'm going to walk anyway. But I was thinking that maybe there's some kind of dispensation of this condition that they suspect something very wrong with his foot, but something that maybe we have a rule out of you. You should be aware of it. Just think that someone's picking on you. No single rabbi is permitted to give a dispensation to the mikvah by day. You have to have two, and for obvious reasons. the lady starts haranguing the rabbi. Rabbi, you do this and this and this and this. It's going to be crazy. The rabbi always say, look, I can't give you it. I can't issue any possession of my own. You have to have the agreement of two rabbis. That was a takana we made. Two rabbis? So we can, to consult one another about the special circumstances. We look it up in the books. We'll just read. Not in this case. It could go to 7, could go to 8, could go to 9, could go to 8 by day either. So the reason this you gave it a dispensation to go right before the convention, to come back and hug under the out of the house, but okay, fine. So I thought nothing. We did it. 3 months later, I met this lady. I don't see her usually, but this far from here. The rabbi, you saved me. Remember what I say? It turned out there was a fracture. Some fracture where the woman was walking. Had she walked the 2 miles of that fracture, who knows what kind of medical disasters might have turned out. So you see, Baruch Hashem. But you may wonder, why are we so hesitant to give this possession? I'll tell you 2 more stories. It was happening the same day. It was incredible. We never had these things. But I see how the Kodesh Baruch Hu works in this strange way. It was a Friday afternoon. If I'm not mistaken, it was June. And I had 2 Rishas of the same, incredible. I only had a little out of before or after, twice the same day. One, I got a call from somebody. The woman can't go at night, she go by day. Why can't she go at night? She's a physician. She lives in Riverdale? No. Didn't sound right. The whole story didn't sound right to me. Didn't sound right to me. I said, I'm sorry, I have a policy. And then they could walk back. We cannot allow it. But then in the end, she wasn't a physician. I'm called all night, that's what it meant. I'm called like a nurse. She wasn't a physician. Her husband was a physician. And the husband could have walked the whole because they lived at the Capella Parkway. It was a long walk to the mikveh there, and they didn't want it. But they made up a whole story that to convince us that I find out if I do Sherlock Holmes. The same day, I got a call from some individual who spoke to me, I think it was a Hebrew, if I'm not mistaken, how he lives miles from the mikveh. His daughter has to go to the mikveh, and it's a mile away, and this and that, and the other thing, and what's going to be? I said, no. So he starts yelling at me. But Israel, they allow it, and Rabbi X and Rabbi Y, drop all kinds of names in it, so I don't allow it. Now, I'm looking. It wasn't his daughter, it wasn't his wife, he wasn't 2 miles away, he was next door, But it was inconvenient to go at night, I can't believe it's inconvenient. And they made up a whole story, it's a compromiser. That's what he said. But anyway, I've seen a few things already. But the difference, it made a difference in the other case, I knew who the person was. I knew the very, very honest and upstanding person in the community. So it was for her, it's a different story. That's why I didn't know who they were. Now I know who they both were, but I knew a little bit who they were. Anyway, so that's why the people to take advantage of problems. It's very important to keep this halacha. The other rabbis have different positions in different communities, and I'm not coming Khalilah of a class to criticize. That's what we worked out here in our community. Fine. Let's go to Siman Kuf Tzadi Ches, which is one of the longest Siman. It's about Chatzitza. Now Chatzitza, there are 2 major factors on my Torah law. One is what's called Makfid. Makfid means you intend to remove it. You're Makfid, you don't want it. And the other consideration by Torah law is if there's a minority or majority of the body. The majority of the body, and Makfid, the woman that really wants to attempt to remove it, then it renders the entire immersion meaningless by Torah law. Many, which is the first of the Torah Shabbat, say that we have 2 separate areas, the body area, one, and the hair is counted separately. And some say not only the hair, but also anything which regenerates, which is constantly, like for example, nails. So the hair and the nails, according to many authorities, have a more stringent rule than the rest of the of the body because they're viewed as independent units, and it could be that the majority can be achieved much more easily than the majority in fire body. Now, the Ram law says, at the very beginning of the small sinner, that although the actual law is followed, there are four cases, there are two parameters, there are four cases, the majority and the minority, makfid and not makfid. Like you want to remove it, you don't want to remove it. So if the majority and you want to you intend to remove it, that's no good in a Torah. If it's the majority you don't want to remove it, or if it's the minority you want to remove it, so the rabbi says it's no good. If it's the minority and you don't want to remove it, that's okay. It's called mir she'en ha'makfid. And if a woman, and I get this question on a regular basis, the woman comes back from the mikvah, and she says, oh, I just found teeny, weeny, weeny little thing on my toe or on my ear. This is the most microscopic thing. So my response always is, tell me, if you would see this, and you discover it, and you're on your way to a wedding, when you have to look to know, would you insist on removing it? So very often the answer is no. That's what's called fear. There ain't no master. You don't even ever attempt to remove it. It's only just the victim you want to remove it. That's for religious reasons. That's called ain't no master. So if that's the case, you don't have to go back to the mitzvah. The first conversion was kosher. However, that's the after the fact. But Kapila, before we begin, we try to remove everything. Even what's called a mir shem amak, we try to remove it if it's at all possible. That's a very important rambo. Okay. I want to tell you that, I want to start with the horror story, because I want to get this, put it to start. Plus the fact of in order. Scabs. Now there's a famous horror story, which is repeated in many rituals, that the attendant is told by the rabbonim, you have to remove scabs, come what may. And another documented case like this. There was the rabbonim who said, based on the sources, a scab, what's the problem with the scab? The problem with the scab is, you see the skin is not a patita, obviously, that's the skin. So the scab develops, they often the hard part on top and the soft part on the bottom, and the hard part really is straight, you don't really use that much. So remove it. Remove it. You know, you can't remove the extraneous parts. So, well, nothing. It's all together. So if you believe it, you can get it infected. It can be painful. It can be everything. So here and now, we don't follow the rules and regulations. We have different rules. Our rules, if you go back to Shemarach, is a woman on the scab has to soak the scab until it softens. And if it is ready to come off, after it soaks for a long period of time in warm water, it will come off. If it will not come off after being soaked for a long time, it is not ready to come off. And if it's not ready to come off, even though if you had a microscope, laser surgery, you could sort of split half, one half of the skin from the other. We don't have these things, so we can't. This is part of it needed to keep the thing intact, so you can go into the skin with the skin on. But all of the rules and regulations here. Yes. But an extra long time soaking it, and it will come off. A little bit. If it doesn't come off, you don't have to pull it over. Okay? Those are the rules you've had at the very beginning. Kind of the heart of the behind us is approaching with more equanimity, okay? Let's not get, a bandage. Shulchan Aruch says a bandage is considered to be a chatzitza. Problem. I want the bandage. If I want the bandage has a status of miut she'eino makfid. It's only a minority. And I wanted it now to protect myself. So why is it considered a chatzitza? There's a famous ruling of the writer in face of the earlier sources, that even though right now you want it on, but anything that you were going to want to remove it into the future, at a future date, it's considered not good even now. And the collapse of the example gives a ring. A ring? Oh, I love the ring. Beautiful one. I wouldn't want to remove it. But in those days, everyone wanted to take off the ring when they needed the dough. Use the dough, the ring, you know, it gets underneath, it gets dirty. Even though now I'm not needing dough, now I'm one of the big ones. But since I want to remove the ring at a future time, it's considered a makfid even now. That's the primary rule over here. Something you would intend to remove in the future is considered a makfid, something which is considered a chatzitza, even now. Some say this is a set time during which it's not to be removed, as opposed to needing dough. You can eat dough whenever you want. I'll bake challah today, I'll bake cake tomorrow, I'll cook it the next day. There's no set time. Until at least now I can't bake anymore. There's no such thing. because it would be a set time. You can't remove this. There's no one have intention to remove it within whatever amount of time, whether it be a week, a month, whatever it may be. Then some suggest it would not be considered a chatzitz. That's relevant. For example, it's one of the reasons why we say that a temporary filling is not a chatzitz. Since the temporary filling is perhaps to wait whatever, X amount of days until whatever has to be done underneath the filling is done. So they say it's a set amount of time, I'm going to remove that will. We'll come to that with other considerations there as well. Furthermore, yes? Doesn't make a difference. The first thing is even 1 week, the difference is 2 days. Well, right now it's still necessary. These 2 days you can't remove it. It's not ready to come out yet. As opposed to needing the dough. You can any minute take off the ring and need the dough. So that's what some say. You can just set them out of bottom and it can happen any minute. What?
You
have to remove it. Another thing. Thank you for reminding me. The rules of Makbid, according to the halacha, are judged on two standards. Your own and the majority of people. If you fail on either standard, you fail. I mean, even if you don't remove your rings to be so, most people remove rings to be so, no rings.
But for like a wedding ring, it was
such a
big simple
that we wouldn't give that stuff. Whoever needs those, now it's pre-kitchen day. Whoever needs those, removes the wedding ring. Most people remove the dough. Pick something. I have to watch the difference in how they need the dough in the old days. I think you can duck the poll and show me otherwise. They will never remove the ring ever. The whole offer might change. But they remove the other ring or they move it now. I don't know. I can't think of why they made a rule.
What about making
up? That's religious reasons. I want that you remove the ring for...
You need that
separate. Right, so you don't have to, maybe you wouldn't have to move for that either. If you don't have to move for the day, you don't have to move for the washing your hands. You have to move some other time, besides the religious rules of Katika. Check the fact. So we generally assume that the ring is considered to be a Katika. Different question. Later, there it is. Can't get it off. What happens then? It's up. A cast is a very serious problem. A cast, obviously, same with the cast. Now I want it on, but it's really something I want it off. So, whether we said now it maybe should be considered a chatzitz. So on the other hand, since it's a set amount of time, I want to take it out, so then maybe it's not a chatzitz. But it's a complicated story. Now there are some casts. You can get wet. You can get wet underneath it. Some care. So in that case, I recommend that the woman should go to the bath and put her hand in the water. Let the water go seep underneath the cast to both sides. So by the time she gets ready to go to the mikveh, it's wet throughout underneath. It's only works for some type of cast. Other than traditional cast, flat to the tires. You can't do that. The plate on your hand is pre-finished. So that is a serious question. Depending on the circumstances and how long it's going to be, we're talking about it. It's a complicated story. What about you can't get the ring off? I get the shot to think every once in a while. Can't get the ring off. So it depends. Very often you can't get the ring off because of this big joint over here. Well, can't get it off? So we all have done the top part. If you can turn the ring with ease, that means you could hear it, okay, the joint is the problem. So you get put a lot of water underneath it to make sure it gets very wet, turn it very, make sure it gets very, that's considered loose, and the water is considered to be getting underneath it. So we don't rely on that like a feeling to try to remove it. If you absolutely can't remove it, you would say to the woman that she may go to the mikveh with the door that's loose. If it's tight, that is a very serious question. Some may say it's not considered a chatzitz because you simply can't remove it. I said before, not because you would tend to remove it. You can't get it off. Forget it. Of course, you could probably call it a jeweler to break the ring. I mean, what that means is you'll never get a ring off. You'll get a broken piece of gold or silver, but you won't get a ring off. But it's complicated. But we obviously try to get it off. Sometimes we try to turn. If not, we think about how to handle the situation. Okay, that's never happened. Usually they're able to turn. All right, let's go on. Stitches. Serious shot. Serious puppy. So we have to roll in the skin of the water. Again, some say it's not considered a chassid if it's not ready to come out yet. Not ready to come out yet because the wound is still healing. Others say no, but if you're going to be locked for next week, you're going to be locked even now. It depends. If it's dissolved, the stitches will make it. Okay. If it's dissolved, you're not going to remove it. You're going to go on that stuff. That's okay. It's present. Okay. Not dissolved, the stitches, we look at the situation again, see how long it's going to be, what we're talking about. There's grounds to be lenient, though, in some circumstances. But it's only true when the stitches are still doing their job. It still works. Very often what happens is the stitches already finished their job. But the doctor has no hours that day. You know, come back in a week. Someone who has no hours, come back in 2 weeks. You know, but meanwhile, that second week, the stitches are not performing any function. That is really a good reason. But of course, the problem often is, we all know. I got a call just not long ago. There was a surgery, stitches, and there was X days after the surgery, and the lady pulled up, and what to do? I called the plastic surgeon, and those are the stitches are going up. He thinks it should be there for at least Y amount of days, which is greater than the X that they were in. You don't know, you're not sure. So therefore I call if it is not a chassidus, that he can't take a chance. If you don't know that this wound has been healed completely, out, so then that's enough to make it as bad as an anal match. You get a quarter of those things, something you do. There's a horror story here again. I have a famous case I had. Again, out of town, on a Friday, Friday's always. And there was a dentistry case. It was the mouth. There we can be a little bit more lenient in the mouth. The mouth, the water going into the mouth. That's what we call royal leviathan. That's what we fit for the water to come in. A little bit more lenient. But there was a big question whether the stitches was serving a purpose or not. One of the doctors said, well, maybe they did it, they didn't take it out, the doctor said, no hours. So I said, well, look, if the stitches are still doing their job, you should go to the mishnah with the stitches in. Because that phrase was if, it was a prize flag, if I wasn't really focused, I found out maybe a long time later, I remember there was a tension in the air, it was terrible, it was a terrible thing. The wife said, I'm not taking time. Two choices. You have to spawn the victim, or go to make a decision. It's going to be lenient. But husbands said, are there those who are most strict? Yes. He said, well, she has to take him out. He said, no, either she'll go like this or she'll postpone it. No, I'm not going to postpone it. Through the room, there was a power play. He had that found out later, this unfortunate woman, under pressure from her, I don't want to say the word about the husband, or with any adjectives, pulled out the decision. And then sure enough, it started to bleed, and he's got an infection. Who knows what kind of terrible thing. This is not my side. You know, I mean, not what I said, but it shouldn't do. So these are very, be very careful with these questions. Okay, let's get back to some other situations. What about color? A woman colors her nails, colors her face, colors parts of the body, etc. So the Shulchan talks about it. He says, strictly speaking, it's okay. Say if you have some kind of makeup or something, the color is here for one of two reasons. You can see the color of the part. One is the noise, the beauty. I call the chassid. The second one is ain mo mamish. It does not have substance like that. No substance, it's into the skin. It's right. If you were to say, for example, take a silly case, take a pen, you write on your hand, but you can't feel that. That's in the skin, it's not considered a chassid. Of course, since there are two reasons, the question is which reason is right. Can we rely on either of them, or we need both? Because it could be case in one or the other. Here's the pen case. See, it's not pretty, but on the other hand, there's no substance. And the cases where it's pretty, but there is substance. For example, very often the nail polish. There's a lot of substance on it. It's pretty,
try to remove all these things. But if it's push comes to shove, the rule for leniency is one of either one of the criteria is met. It's not. But ideally, these things should be removed. As a matter of fact, speaking about nails, as I mentioned before, nails are a very strict issue, and so Manara says be very careful if something should get stuck, dirt underneath the nails. Therefore, the Shabbat called the custom, it was really prevalent for hundreds of years. When a woman goes to the mikvah, she cuts her nails. Where exactly? Well, the original custom was to cut by the skin line, which is pretty long, relatively speaking. Later on, the custom evolved to cut it down to the white line, and there's nothing white showing. A later customer, something will happen. Okay? But that's not really a requirement. The reason to cut it down to the white is so nothing gets stuck underneath at that point. Unfortunately, with the advent of the modern era, the women who refused to cut their nails. And in Vilna, some 60, 70 years ago, they came to the rubber primaries and said, what do we do with these ladies? They refused to cut their nails. So, some said you shouldn't let them in. The rule of Hatzit. And that's the nail. Other things, there's more serious matters. The question was, what to do. So, as I always quip, the big contender did not be trained in karate. But the standard after, yum! Not to let in. So I always say, if a woman insists on going in with what we consider to be Hatzit, Sure, Hatitza? So, she goes. And as a matter of fact, I have a story of the previous mixed-attendant rest of her abundant, of Baltimore, yes, and I have other abundant, who said that if a woman goes in with a Hatitza, the mixed-attendant should look very carefully to make sure that all the hair goes under the water. That's a main job. The main job of this place is to make sure all the hair goes under the water. If you have one hair that sticks out, then it's nothing. Then the mikvah, you never went. That was the chatzitza, probably a minority of the body, so by Torah law, the immersion is the proper immersion. So you should make sure to look that the hair goes under the body, say, if your hair is going under the water. That's a fair deal.